This is Hacker Public Radio, Roundtable, episode number 2. The topic today is there such a thing as ethical hacking, or are we all just evil? I've got three panelists on with me. I've got 330 from linuxcranks.info.
Hello.
I have Nick from the Open Source Musicians podcast.
Hey.
And I got AJ from Linux Geekdom podcast.
Hey there, guys.
So, actually, I think, 330, I know you've been on HPR a couple of times. Nick, is this your first HPR episode?
It is.
Cool. And AJ, this is your first HPR episode.
Yes.
Great. So, that's cool. So, I guess first we should probably start by defining what exactly we are talking about when we say hacking. I know that there's penetration of networks.
Let's say,
yeah, there's cracking.
As far as I figure it, there's only two groups that ever call themselves hackers. There are hackers, who are people that sit down at a problem and pound on it until they find a solution.
Yeah.
And then there are criminals, which do the exact same thing, but do it for a criminal reason.
I believe they are called crackers in
crackers
a lot of...
instead of hackers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just call them criminals.
Hackers.
They already have a name. Call them felons.
And yet there is the concept of an ethical hacker.
Yeah, well, usually an ethical hacker is someone who does a criminal act, but for a good reason. Like people that DDoS child porn sites and things like that. It's basically direct action. It is absolutely illegal, but you're doing it for a higher reason.
And then there's people who work at different security companies that are basically glorified beta testers, but are hacking networks so as to find loopholes so as to patch them.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But that's usually their own internal network that they're hacking.
Usually, yeah, but not always. Sometimes they're hired by outside companies to hack
But it's still usually a sanctioned network. It's not like they're sitting out on the internet trying to break things.
Yeah, they have written permission and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and
when I think of hacking, especially on the hardware side, you know, I think of making something do what it's not meant to do.
And that can be a lot of fun, hardware hacking.
Yeah, and that's a whole other dimension. And strangely enough, there's a criminal element to that, too, at least if you follow the letter of the law, because companies
don't want you messing with their intellectual property.
Which is kind of weird and ridiculous to me, but I guess that's the question, huh?
It kind of makes you wonder, though. It's you bought the hardware. They're never really going to get it back. Why would they really care?
Say, a lot of times they don't unless there's a service attached to it, like TiVo. TiVo is a GPL V2 device. By the GPL, you can do pretty much whatever you want with it as long as you don't restrict anyone else from doing it. But because there's a networked service behind it, if you hack your TiVo and then put it on the TiVo network of software and stuff, they can make your TiVo no longer work.
Well, and the same was true
with a lot of game consoles, too.
Okay.
If you hack your game console, you can no longer play online games, that sort of thing.
So, that's them definitely telling you that you're not allowed to do something with your hardware that you purchased. And if you do anything that they can detect that is out of the realms of their intention, you don't get to play ball with them.
See, I think the whole hacking industry, you could say, is just, whether it be software or hardware, the whole thing really just depends on your motives behind it. Like, it was brought out earlier. If you're trying to find, like they said, shut down the child porn sites. I remember some guy in the, trying to remember when, this probably, I don't remember exactly, but he hacked the WPA security standard, and he basically had found a hole by hacking it, but then he reported it, so they fixed it, and really saved a lot of people, because that could have opened up a really, really big hole in the entire internet security.
Yeah, so the whole full disclosure kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, as long as you notify everyone after you've destroyed or found the problem with whatever you're hacking on, then it's okay.
And I think there is hacking that's kind of harmless. Like, I've heard of people who have hacked, like, Target's internal network and started messing with the light so it just goes on and off. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that might they be like, what's going on? But it's as long as they don't, like, destroy stuff, steal, like, employee records and stuff or credit card numbers, I mean, that can be kind of harmless. So I wouldn't say I wouldn't say it's ethical, but I wouldn't really say it's unethical.
You know what? I would argue that it was ethical because those people are furthering their knowledge about something, and you never know what they're going to go on to do just because they're starting out hacking Target's, you know, internal lighting system. To me, that's
But by turning the lights off and on, though, you could actually – there are problems with that, yeah.
Yeah, you people create in safety hazards.
Yeah, people inside the store could, you know, run into something, you know, run into one of those shelves and cut themselves or something like that.
Yeah, or panic. All right, so it's unethical. But I still think the spirit is ethical because you are furthering your knowledge. I mean, I guess it's not ethical or unethical that I'm talking about. It's just like being responsible, I guess.
Yeah. It's because, you know, I know how to change the traffic signal outside my house.
Am I going to do it?
Probably not. But the fact that I learned how to do it and know how that system works.
Exactly.
That, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with the knowledge and obtaining the knowledge. It's how you obtain the knowledge and what you do with it later. Information isn't inherently bad or good. It's just information.
Yeah. I know a lot of the stuff hackers use, to be honest, is the stuff, the same information that a lot of networkers use when they're establishing a business's network, say. So, I mean, the same principles and information that go into that, it goes back to the whole, what are you doing with it? Like you said, it's information is information. It's what you make of it or what you do with it.
What about in cases where someone does find something big? I know that, I guess the one that I keep thinking of is Dan Kaminsky when he found this DNS issue that he found over the summer, I guess. Like, there was this big hubbub about it, and then there was a race to find out exactly what the issue was, and then he was going to present the findings at Black Hat or something like, or DEF CON, and, you know, it was this big deal, and, I mean, if he'd released this information earlier, people say, oh, everyone could have exploited it, and it would have been horrific. When you find out this information, how do you choose to keep it to yourself? And if you're not Dan Kaminsky, how do you get it to the proper channels? You know what I'm saying?
It is responsible disclosure. What is, once you find that exploit, you go to the people who own that hardware, who are in charge of making sure it's secure, and say, look, I found this. And if they don't believe you, you show them you found it. And you say, you guys need to fix this. And, you know, don't paste it all over the internet before it has been.
What Dan did was went to all the people that make DNS serving software. He got them all together, I think at Microsoft's campus in Redmond, and went, you guys, this isn't a trick. I actually know how this works. Here's how it works. He did a demonstration for them, and he said, you have to fix this. And it took them 9 months to even do anything about it.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. But it's also, I mean, how do you get that if you're not Dan Kaminsky, you know? Like, I guess you probably wouldn't have found the DNS hole if you weren't Dan Kaminsky. I mean, but I'm just thinking, I mean, how does an average hacker who did find a big security hole, how would you call someone together? I don't know how that works. I guess you just shoot some emails off to the people who own it, huh?
Yeah, and if, you know, if there are bug tracking systems, report it as a bug, but...
Yeah, like hoping that those bug tracking systems are much more effective than Windows bug tracking systems.
Yeah. See, really, the problem is if you're the idea that people have of a hacker, you know, the greasy-haired punk sitting in your mom's basement, you know, with you don't have a coupler anymore, but the War Games type hacker, you're not going to get listened to. And at that point, you know, you have to try everything you can. And then when no one listens to you, you just kind of have to release it to everyone.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those things where if you go through the proper channels and try and get things worked out and nobody listens to you, and then you try again and still nobody listens to you, then it's one of those things, you've done your part, then they're not going to listen to you. Then maybe they'll listen to the entire internet, as it were.
Right, yeah. Sometimes it almost seems like we're exposing like these weird little things that no one wouldn't even know about if we didn't really like pound away at it.
Here's the thing. Human beings aren't that clever. People come up with the same exact idea independently of each other all the time. That's why software patents and stuff like that exist. Two people could have come up with the wheel at the exact same time. Human beings aren't that clever. So if you can think of it, someone else is going to. The best thing you can do is hope to God that you're the first person that found it and that you can get it fixed before the next guy thinks of it. You know, because the DNS flaw that Dan Kaminsky found wasn't that brilliant. He thought, hey, I wonder if this is giving out information in a linear fashion, and it was. And all you have to do is randomize the ports, and then, hey, it breaks that whole flaw. but anyone else could have thought of it.
If someone other than Dan Kaminsky would have thought of it, we all would be in a very bad situation right now.
And so why aren't more hackers being payrolled by these big companies, I wonder?
Probably because the average hacker can find the small bugs, but it's the deeper in-depth holes that the big companies are going to be looking for, or the things that the average hacker just, it's over their heads. And the number of real elite hackers out there, I know personally, I've never really done any hacking. I would love to learn how, but there's so much involved, but the number of real elite hackers out there is just very, very small. There's a lot of the average hackers and the better than average, but the real elite is a very, very small group.
Yeah, but what is hacking then? I mean, isn't it just basically obsessing over something?
That's
for the most part, yeah.
So, I mean, me, someone who sits in front of videos all day and, like, figures out how to transcode and edit differently and stuff like that.
You're
a video hacker, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have people that are, you know, life hackers that, you know, sit there and obsess about how they exist. You know, you have GTD nerds are hackers. How do I do these four things and make myself a million times more productive? It's all still hacking. It's still the same mindset.
It's basically altering something from one form to another, I guess would be the best definition of hacking, because you're taking something as it is and changing it or modifying it in some way to serve a given purpose.
Right. Yeah, but I really do think it takes that obsessive mindset about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people who hack hardware, they know exactly where all the connections are and how they work, and that's how people learn to take a rig, like a computer that most people would be able to get X performance out of and get so much more out of it just by tweaking a couple things. They know how the inner workings work because they've looked at it and studied it and done research on it and then maybe edited the speeds of things and maybe even tweak the hardware a little bit. Something to make it work more efficiently than what it had done before.
Yeah, and I think that kind of sums up like the methodology of hacking to me. I mean, you have to have the hard knowledge. Like if you're going to do hardware hacking, for instance, you probably need, like if you're really going to do serious hardware hacking, you need like electrical engineering. You need that understanding. But just having the by the book understanding of it is only going to get you so far. It's going to help you build a computer. But then like going deeper than that and like obsessing over something and saying, well, what if I reroute this one connection over here, or what if I overclock this by attaching this wire, you know, whatever. That's the kind of the obsession, I think, is what gets you into like the really cool discoveries, I guess.
I was just going to bring it back to the why aren't companies paying people to do this. There are companies that are paying hardware hackers, or not hardware hackers, but criminal hackers, and it's organized crime.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the old, you know, what still exists of the Russian mafia hires high school, college kids in America that, you know, that know about these exploits and pay them to write software that any idiot can run. And I mean, that's why all these botnets and stuff are around. You know, it's not because, hey, wouldn't it be funny too? It's, hey, I bet you I can make $100,000 in a week by selling this to the Russian mob.
So you're saying all those spam comments I have on Unix porn from .ru email addresses aren't really people who are fascinated by my site? Darn.
There is a way to make money in it, but it's the same way that people make money dealing drugs and human trafficking. It's all still extremely hardcore criminal elements of things.
I mean,
are people that are paying, but they're not people you want to be involved with.
The way you're talking, though, it makes it sound like the only kind of hacking is criminal hacking.
No, no. I hack things all day. I mean, I'm a very obsessive person. I'll sit there and beat my head on something until it finally cracks. But there are people that they use the hacker ethos, you know, the obsession, and then really it's all exactly the same until the end point where they, instead of going, oh crap, I need to tell people about this, they go, I'm going to shut up and I'm going to sell this.
Okay,
that's
I see
the
point.
Point where it becomes evil hacking, when you're not being responsible with knowledge that you gain.
Yeah, because
I think that's when you cross that line. You're screwing over other people, essentially,
to make money
instead of help to fix problems.
I wouldn't necessarily say evil, because evil has other things attached to it. You're just being a douchebag.
Yeah, there we go.
I mean, you know, evil has, you know, some kind of religious tone to it, and there's multiple sides. To them, they're not evil. They are just trying to make a buck. But I think most people can identify a douchebag when they see it.
Yeah.
You mean the popped collar?
It's the pop collar of hacking, yes.
Yeah.
What about the people, I don't know, like, at least like me, I'm not making any big new discoveries, you know, I'm not exposing any new way of, you know, transcoding a video or a big hole in something, you know, but I still think of myself a bit of a hacker because I sit there and obsess over, well, what if I do it this way or what if I do this or how do I set up, well, like you, 330, I mean, you spent, I don't know how long setting up that server with the OpenGoo server on it and the iOS, you know, I mean, it took you a while. I would consider that hacking, even though it's not like, it's not discovering anything new. Is that still hacking, do you think?
Well, yeah. Not everyone writes the hottest new insert your favorite application here. You know,
yeah.
There are a lot of people that sit around hacking on code, and it's never going to be amazing. You know, people aren't going to clamor for it. No one's going to pay $10,000 a seat for it. You put the same amount of effort into it, and it doesn't make it any less awesome to you or any less hacking. I don't think that you need other people's approval for it to be hacking or to be useful. As long as you find it useful and you worked your ass off on it, you hacked it.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, that's like going up to someone with an iPhone and they say, yeah, I hacked my iPhone. I mean, big deal, you hacked it. What you did was you downloaded like a little installer and you double-clicked on it and it did it for you. It jailbroke it. Doesn't mean you hacked anything. It just means you're a script kiddie for your iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's where the media's use of the term hacking has really screwed everything up. And everybody comes back to this, you know, do we need a new word for it? The media screwed it up, not us.
I guess I think of a hack, there's a hacker with a capital H and a hacker with a lowercase H. And people like me are a lowercase H, and people like, I don't know, Dan Kaminsky are a capital H or something like that.
Well, I kind of think about it like punk rock, all right? You've got Black Flag, which is by far one of the greatest punk rock acts ever to exist.
Sure.
And they are no more punk than the 15-year-old kid, you know, hanging out with his buddies in the garage playing punk rock. It's all punk rock.
Yeah, yeah. I get it. I can relate to that, actually.
I don't think that it really needs to have a hierarchy.
Right.
I think people really are spending way too much time of their life classifying things. Yeah, you know, they categorize and they subcategorize and they subcategorize and they sub. Stop
but
wasting
isn't
that time and go hack something.
That is hacking. That's hacking categorization. Without those people, we would have nothing but just, you know, everything would be lumped in together.
I can't argue with that. I can't argue with it.
Okay, what about this? What about the companies, you know, getting back to the hardware stuff, because that's kind of interesting to me. What about these companies that are saying you can't hack this? I mean, is it unethical for them to say that we can't hack their hardware?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you think about it. They're basically saying we're the only ones who can make progress in the computer industry for a graphics card, a sound card, a motherboard, a hard drive, anything. I mean, they're basically trying to monopolize the industry by controlling the progress based on how they make it so that when the next greatest thing comes out, it wasn't released by some guy who figured out a better way to do it from Idaho in his basement. It was figured out by a big company who can then really profit from it.
Well, say, I don't think that a lot of companies are actually telling people you can't do this. You know, they tell you, go right ahead and have fun, but you'll void your warranty.
Or we'll brick your device in some cases.
Like I said, there aren't many, but that means there are some. Yeah, you know, without naming names, companies like that tend to do that across the board of their entire product line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually into other product lines that may converge with their product line.
There are a lot of companies out there that when they release a firmware upgrade, they'll add this great, nice new feature, but they've learned about this hack that a ton of people have done to their device. That firmware upgrade will try to disable your device completely if you've on the hack just because it no longer gives them complete control over what you're allowed to do with it.
Yeah, the thing I'm thinking of with that is like the Sony PSP. You buy a brand new game and it reloads your firmware and all of a sudden you can't play, we'll call them homebrew games. But really what they're trying to stop is software piracy.
See, part of the thing that really bugs me there, because I knew it would come up, is you are allowed to legally make one copy of every game you own. But if, you know, they disable any way that people come up with for you to play that legal backup,
but
you know, technically
if the original source is encrypted, which I can't think of a game that doesn't come unencrypted except for maybe World of Goo at this point. You know, maybe some independent stuff. But all that is encrypted. And due to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, if you circumvent encryption, you don't even have to break it. If you can copy it in place with the encryption, you've still broken the idea of encryption, and you're still in violation.
No, you're not violating it if you don't encrypt that data.
That's being debated in court right now.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, wow. The idea is that if you made a copy of a DVD as a full ISO file, bit for bit, exactly the same, what you've
like
done is you've what you've done then is circumvented the idea of the encryption, the intent of the encryption. Yeah, and we as in people that actually don't want this kind of thing to happen, may lose this fight and lose it hard.
Oh, that would be... Then basically they're saying if you lose your disk and you wanted to make backups, you can't make backups, and if you lose your disk, you're out of luck, you'll just have to go buy another one.
Well, they tell you to go buy a backup. Why don't you have two copies of it? Go buy two copies.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
so
I'm taking the devil's advocate on that point. I want everyone to know that I think that's bullshit. And I think that it's just unfathomable how someone could actually think that. But, playing devil's advocate, why don't you just go buy two copies? People that buy comic books that want one to read and one to save forever, they go buy two. They don't make a copy of their comic book to read and then have the one that they bag and board.
Yeah, but that's different. DVDs aren't exactly something you're going to save forever as unless it's like some special collector set of Star Wars signed by George Lucas or something. I mean, it's one of those
things. The thing. To these companies, it is. A product is a product. They don't care what format it's in. It's like MP3. If you download an MP3 that's DRM, you have no reason to want to back that up.
And you see, I think the by the industry doing this and causing all this encryption on data and saying we don't want you to back it up or do this, basically by trying to prevent piracy, they've increased it. And things like the Pirate Bay, I mean, it said this past year they just got to over 7 million users, and that's not counting all the people who don't sign up for it but still get torrents from there. You think about that, these companies are saying we don't want to lose money, we don't want people stealing our data. But if they were to keep it unencrypted and available to people, then they wouldn't have as big a problem with this, because people would be like, okay, I buy a song off iTunes, I can put it on as many devices as I want, but now it's like, you can put it on like just a couple devices, and if something happens to your collection or those devices, you're screwed. So,
say, here's a question. Are the guys at the Pirate Bay hackers?
Yes, I would have to say
I would say yes as well, because they're getting around something. They're getting around a problem, a roadblock.
To be honest, I think anyone who uses torrents is a hacker, but kind of like the lowercase h type hacker, not the.
You're categorizing again.
No, come on, not at this point. Any mouth breather can use a torrent site. It's not that hard.
Mouth breather, but. Yeah, most.
No, believe me, I spent several hours with a mouth breather a couple days ago, and he was torrenting. But
all right.
I mean, I'm talking lowest common denominator here, and he could do it. If you actually, like, listen to discussions with the guys from the Pirate Bay, they are absolutely hackers. It's a totally decentralized thing. No one knows who did any of it. They have this admin account that anyone that asks can get the password to. And you just make your change and walk away from it. That's how it became the number one greatest store with no price on the internet.
Well, it's kind of like they've basically taken what Napster did and fixed all the mistakes. Napster's real mistake was just having a centralized location. So basically you're saying they decentralized location, so they've done what torrenting does, and that if you lose one person, you still got 100,000 to back it up.
Say, but it's not even the location that they decentralized. There's no chain of command. Yeah, you know, in their recent court case, they kept going, who is the man on top? Who's the admin? And they went, everyone?
There is none.
You know, and the courts can't get their heads around an idea that it may just be something that exists. No one owns it. It's just there.
Yeah.
And I think
it's just out in cyberspace.
Yeah, and that's the biggest hack. It has nothing to do with the software or, you know, en rooting around laws or any of that. It's they hacked the way people think. And that's the most important part of that. Is, you know, changing your hardware, your software, any of that. That's, you know, those are all end goals. But really, hacking is about changing the way you think about something.
I must say, I'm impressed. These guys.
Yeah, it is just a thing that exists on its own.
Yeah, see, what's also really cool is,
you know, right now they still need the Pirate Bay app as a tracker.
Well, they're working on ways for decentralized tracking. So if their servers got blown up tomorrow, all those torrents are still available. And it could just move anywhere in the world. It wouldn't matter.
So here's the really interesting thing is, and you'll have to go back into other HPR episodes because I don't remember the name of the broadcaster, but the same broadcaster that put out all the Beatles tracks a couple months ago on BitTorrent, they are actually using the software that the guys from the Pirate Bay created to run their own tracker site instead of, you know, like in the U.S., all the media companies put it up in streaming Flash. You know, you go to CBS and you can watch pretty much whatever you want, but it's in Flash and it's only there for as long as it's there. These guys are actually putting this out on BitTorrent and going, have at it. I don't know if they have ads or anything in it, but if they do, you can sell the ad as, this ad will be seen forever because we're going to put this out here and people are going to be able to share this thing. So you're going to get between 10,000 and 600 million views.
And that's a really smart way of doing it. And you're going to get that media out there to anyone who would ever want to listen to that music.
Right.
Because there's no
the
limitations.
Idea.
You don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And,
we'll say, or yep. Watch that TV show or, you know. Because, like, I think it's a nationalized media thing. You know, it's kind of like PBS in America. Well, it's more like the BBC in England, where it's paid for through tax money or, you know, some kind of TV license or something for the benefit of everyone in that country. So they've already made their money off of it. The taxes were already collected. It's just stuff now that's sitting around. And they don't have, like, the BBC where they're exporting it everywhere because not everyone speaks, I think it was Swedish, it might have been.
I thought it was Norway, but yeah, whatever.
They're just giving it away because there's no, they don't really have another revenue source, and they're not really interested in waiting for one to show up, so why not just give people the thing they already paid for? And
well,
I personally, I love the idea of the perpetual ad. Like, just going, we can guarantee you that it'll get this many downloads because everything else did, but after that, you could grow tenfold. So, you know, pay us for what we know you'll get, and hopefully we can negotiate a little bit more, and you'll probably get a million times more than you ever paid for.
Yeah, well, it's a brilliant scheme, I think, and it's you know, the whole open source model in a way, because you're just saying, here's the information. Take it whenever you want it. I mean, that's kind of, I don't know if that's open source or hacker ideal or whatever, but it's the same idea, I think.
Well, that kind of
really
source
cool.
Was a hack. The whole idea of,
yeah.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
Of free software and open source. It was
right.
A hack. It was a hack, and it was a hack of the way people thought of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
Which people are
about,
still trying to wrap their mind around.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, people are still thinking in a lot of ways that open source must somehow be piracy, but I think you're you hit the nail right on the head with the idea that open source is a hack, because you think about programs like Microsoft's Office Suite, and then you think of things like OpenOffice.org, where they do all the same things, whereas one's several hundred dollars, the other's free. Obviously, there's got to be some similarity in code there, so obviously there's at some point been a hack to get that code. Maybe I'm doubting it was illegal, but it was obviously someone hacked it so as to say, you know, I don't feel like buying that, but I still want the features and services. They basically just said, hey, I'm going to write a program to do what I need it to do. And then when they got it working, they put it out on the internet. And now pretty much everyone who uses Linux uses OpenOffice, and they released a version for Windows. So now
OpenOffice is kind of a bad example there, but, you know, that's how a lot of software came about. But OpenOffice started as StarOffice, which was bought by Sun, later open source, and then renamed to OpenOffice.
Yeah, say, and really that, again, goes back to my point that people aren't clever. How many different people had the idea of a word processor, which is basically some kind of markup language that formats a page for printing? I doubt Microsoft was the first
basically,
one to have it. I mean, you know, we can all sit around, you know, as soon as I said that, everyone started going, I could do it. You know, little XML here and there, and it spits out a page the way you put it on the screen. You know, and there are probably a million ways to do it. So I'm sure that there are similar things between Office and OpenOffice. They're probably functionally completely different, and actually that's a good thing. No one ever has the perfect idea. They just have the idea that was good enough to make the damn thing work.
True. And that's where people use the program, and one reason open source is so successful, because people write a program, people use it and go, you know, I would really like this feature or that feature in it. And then people are like, hey, that's not a bad idea. They integrate it, updates released, it's installed, and boom, now you've got exactly what you were looking for.
And then you have 100 other people going, that feature's awesome, but you totally did it wrong.
Exactly. But that's why open source is so beautiful, because you can customize it exactly the way you want.
Exactly. And at that point, they submit the patches for what they think it should be. If they're not accepted, they can fork and have their own project do it the way they envision it.
Okay, so hacking so far is being judged ethical because it brings all of us free stuff, like stuff that we don't want to pay for. It reveals security problems, and it possibly reveals advancements in, like, either hardware or software progress, or just kind of the way everyone thinks.
Hacking in itself is ethical. The act of learning something new by being obsessive and just pounding your head at it, there's nothing unethical about that. It's what you do with your end result. And that's just like everything. If you built a firework in your backyard, if you shoot it up in the air and it explodes, it's a firework. But if you point it at someone and it explodes and kills someone, you've made a grenade. You've made a rocket explosive. The same exact thing can do two separate things, and one is ethical and one isn't.
It's how you use it. And people use things a lot of times not for reasons not designed or not intended by the maker. People will take something like, say, a knife that was designed to chop vegetables and use it to murder someone.
Setting up a server in my own house and breaking in through SSH because of some vulnerability in, let's say I had an old Debian box and I could break the key because it was only 16-bit. If I do it to myself, there's nothing wrong with it.
I agree.
Okay, but here's the question, because, I mean, I agree with what is being said, but it sounds like some of our, quote, ethical, yeah, it's ethical, unquote, is based on our particular moral basis, you know, so we're saying, well, it's ethical because it, you know, skirts taking advantage of people who can't afford an Office Suite, or it's showing these companies that they don't control their own hardware or whatever, you know? I mean, who decides whether this is a good thing or a bad thing? Like, mightn't a hardcore capitalist say, well, this free software stuff is, you know, basically copying an idea from someone else and giving it away for free? and that's bad or something like that? I mean, why are we saying it's ethical? Or was the question wrong anyway?
Or
you said someone's coming from the point of, okay, will this make me money? Well, I think the question should be is, will this benefit humanity? Step back, take a look at it as a whole. You know, in 100 years, will it matter if that guy made money or if we did something that benefited everybody?
Right.
So I think that's more of a viewpoint
that's
we
a
should
good
be
point.
Coming from.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for being on, Nick, from Open Source Musicians Podcast. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you, AJ, from Linux Geekdom Podcast.
I love being here. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, both of you, since this was your first HPR episode, and anyone else listening, if you ever want to contribute a Hacker Public Radio episode, it is an open forum. It's a community-based podcast. All you have to do is email either me or Enigma, or you know, just get on the website hackerpublicradio.com and find the email link to submit a show. And generally speaking, we're really happy to get them. And thank you, 330. And you're from Tilt now, right?
Yeah.
Something kind of techie. What else?
Free Linux Helpline.
Free Linux Helpline. What's the site for that, by the way? FreeLinuxHelpline.net. Okay, FreeLinuxHelpline.net. That's a really cool new podcast that helps people with Linux questions, and mm-hmm. It can be a live call-in show even.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, so this has been the second round table for Hacker Public Radio. My name's Klaatu, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net. So head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.